Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Greg Caponia. Tonight, our topic is county health rankings and understanding the rankings in the Lehigh Valley. I would like to welcome our guests, Ed Meehan, the Executive Director of the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust and the Ryder Poole Foundation. Edward's been in this position since 1983. The two philanthropies, with combined assets of over $90 million, broadly support health, wellness, and community development in our Lehigh Valley. We also welcome his colleague, Ronald Dendis, the program officer for the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust and the Ryder Poole Foundation. For two decades in this role, Ronald has managed more than $50 million in grants in support of diverse projects for the Lehigh Valley. Suffice it to say that both of our guests have decades of working in the area of public health and community. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good to be with you, Greg.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Community health is something that we're all very, very interested in. Before we dive into it, while the names Ryder Poole are familiar to many of us, can you just give us a little bit of history about the namesakes, please?
Sure. Let me talk a little bit about Leonard Parker Poole and Dorothy Ryder Poole. They're the founders of the Ryder Poole Foundation and the Poole Healthcare Trust. Mr. Poole, interestingly, was from Minneapolis initially, and he was the fourth of seven children, grew up in a poor family, and because of his dad's illness and his parents' illness, he had to really take care of the family finances at a young age. He had to quit school and did a lot of different very odd jobs, but early on in his life and throughout his life, there were several things that became really apparent that were extremely important to him. One was family, community and people and taking care of people, and he sacrificed his own education in order to do that. Education as an extremely important dynamic for Leonard, and health and health care. He was actually interested in being a physician, but couldn't, but he enabled his baby brother to be a doctor. So I think most people in Lehigh Valley know Leonard as the gentleman who founded Air Products and Chemicals, which is probably the single largest gift he made to the Lehigh Valley. And his second largest gift to the Lehigh Valley was the founding of what is now Lehigh Valley Health Network. His interest in healthcare and Dorothy's great illness and passing prompted Leonard to really think about building a superior regional hospital that, of course, has now become Lehigh Valley Health Network. And I guess you would say the third gift of Leonard's to the Lehigh Valley is the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust, which is a support trust that enables Lehigh Valley Health Network to be a superior regional hospital, but also enables Lehigh Valley Health Network and others to think about the broad health and improvement of health of the Lehigh Valley. Dorothy Ryder was from Detroit originally, and they met in the late 1920s and married in the early 1930s. Dorothy was a school teacher in the Detroit City Schools. She taught music and she taught art and history. And so again, the theme of education being extremely, extremely important. So they founded the Ryder Poole Foundation in 1957 with a focus on the Lehigh Valley and quality of life in Lehigh Valley. And with Dorothy's illness and then passing in 1965, Leonard was interested in really thinking about the health. And then as opposed to having the residue of his estate go into the Ryder Poole Foundation, he founded the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust. So the Poole Trust started in 1976 with the passing of Leonard in late 75. We started with $15 million. We are probably about $80 million today, and we've made about $140 million of grants to improve the health of the Lehigh Valley and work with Lehigh Valley Health Network to enable them to become the superior regional hospital that they are today. So it's a great story. It's an American story, and it is just a tribute to the entrepreneurial spirit of Leonard Poole and the great cultured intellectual approach to quality of life and helping people from Dorothy. Ron and I are very proud to support that legacy.
Gentlemen, these are not people who grew up with money. Why do you think that they wanted to go into the area of community health and community in general? What was the driving force behind this?
The company started not in the Lehigh Valley, obviously, and actually flourished because Mr. Poole had obviously Air Products and Chemicals makes gas and oxygen products. And during World War II, their services and products were very much in demand. So they they moved around a bit, but they were in the South. And after the war, they were looking for a place. Kind of interestingly, I've always thought that in a way they were kind of way ahead of themselves yet again. They were kind of looking for the Silicon Valley in the 1950s. They were looking for a place that was close to major marketplaces like New York and Philly. They wanted good quality of life. They wanted to attract researchers and scientists and engineers, and they wanted good quality of life for families. And so they really made Lehigh Valley their adopted home. And Dorothy, with her inclination toward education and the arts, just got very involved in philanthropic activities, supporting those things in the community. And Leonard, as I joke sometimes, you know, he wanted to be a physician, but he couldn't, so he had to become a Fortune 500 CEO. And again, his interest in health from a very, very early age, very much heightened by Dorothy's illness and his frustration with the fact that while he could take her to Sloan Kettering in New York or to Pennsylvania Hospital and get care anywhere in the world that for her, he really struggled and wrung his hands about what do my employees do for their health care, what do their families do for their health care, and what does the Lehigh Valley do for its health care. So very tenacious individual, and there was some strife in the early days, but obviously it's a long, long game, and this story continues to evolve.
What do you think the namesakes would think of the Lehigh Valley today?
The expression that many of Leonard's close associates, who I've had the pleasure to learn from and to work for over the years, would say, one of their expressions about Mr. Poole was that he would be pleased, but never entirely satisfied. So I have a funny feeling that he would be pleased with the fact that his baby, Lehigh Valley Health Network, is the superior regional hospital that it is today. I think he would be pleased that he relocated his company and that the company had a great deal to do with the growth and evolution and prosperity of the Lehigh Valley. I think he'd be, and I think Dorothy also would be quite pleased with the progress to date, but I'm not sure that they would be satisfied. And for example, he was interested in the health of the Lehigh Valley as his adopted home. And the thinking in the 1960s was, well, you need more doctors and you need more hospitals. You need to build a superior regional hospital. He did that. I think, and as we talk here and during this next period of time, that if he looked at health circumstances today and he had a real inclination for trying to find the best and the brightest. Who knows about this? Let's find that person and let's learn from them about what needs to be done. Increasingly, we realize that healthcare is extremely important, but it's missing some huge chunks of the puzzle if you're really going to think about the health of the entire community. So I think what he'd think about and Dorothy would think about today was, boy, the Lehigh Valley's just done really well and we're so happy that we were able to help it in our lives and continue to help it through the legacy that we've left. And boy, there's so much more work to do because it's not what it should be just yet.
Well, that's a good dovetail into the county healthcare rankings, which we are really here to talk about today. County healthcare rankings come out every year, don't they?
Yes.
Before we get into the unique situations that we all face now, there are 67 measured counties in Pennsylvania and Lehigh and Northampton. They seem to rank pretty good. What are your thoughts on that?
The county health rank, I can't remember how many years they've been in effect, but
this is the 11th year.
This was an effort that was started by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and it is conducted by the University of Wisconsin. And the idea behind it really is to try to raise consciousness and awareness about the multiple factors that influence health, and then try to create a reliable source of data that would give communities some comparison and hopefully stimulate local action for communities to think about how they can improve.
These are data-driven points.
Yes.
And approximately how many people are surveyed when they do these types of county surveys? How do they get their data?
Some of the data are gathered through a large survey that's done by the CDC called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. But most of the data from here are from state and local health records. So they're not necessarily surveys. They are looking at prevalence and incidence of particular health-related factors.
There's no bias on anything here.
The intention is for it to be empirical data, yeah, from multiple sources.
The rankings have two categories, health outcomes and health factors. And the rankings, I should tell our listeners, just the overview is about 9 or 10 pages long, but the first items are health outcomes and health factors. What's the difference?
Well, health outcomes are what we use to measure how healthy our communities are. And so they really kind of look at two factors, the length of life and the quality of life. And in those two particular areas, the Lehigh Valley is slightly better than average. I mean, our overall health outcomes are good. When you divide out length of life and quality of life, what you see are two very different stories. Length of life, people live a longer than average life in the Lehigh Valley. Quality of life, majority of the folks do not enjoy the quality of life that they could if their health was good. So we're really good at one part and not so good at the other part. When you combine them for the overall health rankings, we come out slightly better than average. Mm-hmm. But it really is a tale of two cities.
So would you say that the factors outweigh the rankings in a way?
The factors are what affect the outcome. So why do we have longer length of life? Well, one of the factors is we have access to really good quality health care. When you look at why our quality of life factors aren't as good, well, when you start looking at the health factors, you see three pretty predominant things. One is people aren't behaving in healthy ways. There's higher than average smoking. There's higher than average binge drinking. Obesity rates are high. You can look at social and economic factors. There's high concentration of poverty. There are neighborhoods with high unemployment rates. There are school districts that don't have the best graduation rates. So we see education as a determinant of health. We see housing as a determinant of health. Our physical environment. So all of these factors go into influencing the health outcomes, the things that make us sick and eventually kill us.
So you're really talking about Lehigh Valley is a community, but then there are various communities within our community.
Very much so, yes. Yes. The health factors in Lineport are very different than the health factors in Center City, Allentown.
Let's do this. When you look at all the data, define community. Define communities if you can.
Let me take a stab at it. You're looking at county health rankings, and if you're going to do this on a national basis, my goodness, getting it county by county is pretty daunting. So really kudos to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Yeah, it's an amazing document.
It's an amazing 50 states in the union, every county and every state in the union, looking at not just health outcomes, but looking at the social and economic factors. So that's really terrific, but it gives you a jumping off point. So two things that we're talking about here. One is, you know, sort of if you look at clinical care and in health outcomes in Lehigh and Northampton County, it looks pretty good because we know we have good hospitals, and this verifies that the quality of health care is quite good. Where we slip in the rankings is, as Ron was saying, the social and economic factors, what is increasingly known as the social determinants of health, education levels, safe and healthy housing, integration of health and mental health. So those things kind of drag us down. So increasingly you start to see, well, while we have good health care, it's not getting at some of the things that we need to think about if we're going to improve the health, the overall health of the Lehigh Valley. Now, within that, as good as the county health rankings are, the counties are just too large to be able to say, you know, when you look at the whole population of Lehigh Valley, neighborhoods just wash out. You know, you can't see them that well until you get down to a more granular level. So, you know, as Ron was saying, pick, you know, Lineport versus, you know, the old fairgrounds, Allentown Fairgrounds neighborhood, or pick Southside Bethlehem versus Hanover Township. There's differences in socioeconomic factors that are going to change and influence health. So in order to be able to think about how do you improve the health of the entire Lehigh Valley, you have to think a little bit more about how do we do a deeper dive even beyond the county health rankings to figure out where are those socioeconomic and health factors at most disadvantage, and how do we address them in a way that would meaningfully improve health. So to define community for me is well, it's commune, you know, who talks to who relates to who. My general sense of a community is I don't know a community until I ask people who live there, hey, what's your community? And mm-hmm. they'll generally tell you with some pride what neighborhood they live in, what association they belong to, what congregation they're part of, and you can work with that. So you're dealing with several different forces here. One is when we professionals look at population data, we're looking at it by census tract or county or municipality or borough, but people don't say, oh, I live in census tract 10. They'll say, I live in, you know, I attend such and such, you know, a church and belong to this congregation. As you were saying, this is not subjective information. The county health rankings is empirical data. It's from secondary data sources and analyzed. Now, how do you merge that with the information that you can get at a neighborhood level to understand a little bit more about people's lives, what are the challenges they have in their lives, and integrate those two things in a way where you can have a meaningful response?
Gentlemen, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You are listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Greg Caponia. Today we have Ed Meehan and Ron Dendis from the various Writer Pool Foundations. Thank you for being with us today, gentlemen. Talking about disparities in the various communities, money matters, doesn't it?
Absolutely does.
Any number of forces that impact health matter. And we have increasingly been studying what is generally now known as social determinants of health, and things like income level, education level, quality of housing matter. They make a difference.
And we have so many different diverse communities. What is the block, or why would one community be more unhealthy or have less healthy opportunities, if you will?
I would, in summarizing it in one word, I would say options. What options do people have in choosing health? If you have mm-hmm. to make a decision between paying rent or buying your medication, you know, that's you don't have the option of doing both. You have to make a decision on which one. There could be places where you can exercise. If you don't have the option to access those, if you can't access those exercise areas, how do you maintain good health? If there aren't fruits and vegetables accessible to you for a variety of reasons, whether it's being able to afford them or being able to get to a store to buy them, you know, those options matter.
So when we're talking about community health, what's the biggest need right now? Is it food? Is it education on, say, smoking?
I don't think you can summarize it into, you know, if we could only do this one thing, that would move the needle. I think we've tried that for generations. If we could only do this, if we only improve this, I think when you start looking at neighborhoods where there are great disparities in health, there are multiple factors that feed off of one another. And a classic example is if I am a young child and I can't see the blackboard because I don't have glasses, I'm not eating well, I can't perform in school. So is this a health issue? Is this an education issue? The answer is yes. So, you know, how do we get our systems to work together to address common goals, I think, becomes a really important part of the work. But identifying one thing and saying, if we could only change this, now we've got to change multiple things in particular places if we want to see improvement.
Do the majority of the people in the Lehigh Valley see the disparity? I think they care.
Oh, without a doubt, Greg, people care. This is a very caring region. This is a very caring region made up of caring people in communities across the Lehigh Valley. And there's a long, you know, very rich tradition of caring about neighbor and helping others. So people very much do care. But to Ron's point, I think there is historically been an idea that, you know, if we could just fix X, it would be, things would be better if we could just fix Y. And in point of fact, yeah, if we could get at smoking, that would be fantastic. If we could reduce the incidence of smoking, prevalence of smoking in the Lehigh Valley, that would be wonderful. Now, there are smoking programs, there are smoking cessation efforts, but that said, we know that people who have achieved a college education are much less likely to smoke than people who have not completed high school. People in a lower income status have a much higher prevalence of using tobacco. Why is that? You know, why are there certain segments of the community that have a higher incidence of smoking than others? What is that about? And so if you're going after the idea that, well, if we could just inform people that tobacco is bad, they'd quit smoking, that would have happened a long time ago, mm-hmm. because we've been informing people about the dangers of tobacco use since 1965. So this runs a little deeper. There's something about community, there's something about culture, there's something about how people live their lives that either enable them or tolerate, you know, a risky health behavior versus communities that maybe it's a little less comfortable to smoke. I just, not a Lehigh Valley example, but one I think about all the time. My sister-in-law grew up in New York City, smoked about 2 packs of cigarettes a day in New York City. We moved to San Francisco, and within 6 months, she quit smoking. Was she interested in quitting smoking? Not really. What happened was she moved to San Francisco, made all new friends, and none of them were smokers. And so she didn't fit in with her new community. She didn't fit in with her new buddies. And so in New York, all of her friends were smokers, and there was a certain camaraderie in that. There was a certain cultural support for that behavior. The power of her fitting in and getting along and not being the odd person out with her new social network in San Francisco was more powerful than the nicotine addiction. So, I mean, just think about that in terms of behavior and the complexity of what we're talking about and trying to change people's behavior. So people are social animals, and they need social supports. If we can enrich social supports in lots of ways, that behaviors might just change without us spending a great deal of time focusing on a specific behavior.
That smoking. So you think about this. Yeah, that smoking situation could be as easy as saying, hey, let's take a coffee break. You might even not like coffee, but your community or your peer group goes out to do something specifically, and so you join them, and it can be a behavior that is harmful to your health. Not that coffee drinking is harmful to your health, but it's what they call it or what they do, I guess, is what you're saying, is what we do as our within our various communities.
Right, right. Well, you can inform people about the risks of tobacco use or not wearing a seatbelt, and you can educate. That's valuable, but it's not the entire piece of, that's just one piece of the puzzle. You can pass rules that say you're not allowed to smoke in this building, and you know, if you want to smoke, you have to go outside. Well, you can have those kinds of regulations or regulatory approaches to it, and that might be a piece of the puzzle as well. But a whole rich dynamic to this health behavior stuff has a lot to do with the things that either enable or inhibit people's behaviors in the first place. And so community is really important. It looms very large in people's lives. And so it becomes what's normative? What's the norm in your circles? I think probably most of the people listening this evening to your show put on their seatbelt when they get in the car.
Yeah.
They're not saying, I'm putting the seatbelt on because it's going to, you know, decrease my chances of a fatality or a serious injury in case of an accident by XX%. They're just doing it because it's what you do.
I remember my mother saying it's going to wrinkle my dress.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know?
So at that moment, your mom's dress was more important.
Right. It's a thought process that we need to get into. You gentlemen have spent your careers in community and public health. How do we illuminate in a better way these factors that affect all of us ultimately? You do good work. It must get frustrating sometimes to say, boy, if they only knew.
I think that's changing. The fact that we're on the radio right now talking about this, I think it's becoming more prevalent to have these kinds of conversations. So in that sense, this concept of county health rankings as a call to action, it's happening.
The word systemic is used a lot these days, but it probably is appropriate here. Ultimately, we all end up paying the price. So often these things come down to, this is mine and this is yours. But ultimately, don't we all end up paying the price through higher taxes or, paying an extra mill on that educational front? What do you think?
Yeah, Greg, let's talk about that for a minute because, you can talk about the health of a population in the Lehigh Valley in so many different ways. We could talk about individual behavior as we just did. But we could also talk systemically. So just think about this. We've said we have an extraordinarily good healthcare system, and we have good health services. We have great doctors, great nurses, great hospitals in the Lehigh Valley.
And we applaud them.
Oh my goodness, and especially in the last several months, thank God for them, and wow, just thank you. Nationally, we spend about 18% of our gross domestic product on health care. That is an extraordinary amount of money. That's huge, and we do pay for that in many, 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 many ways. Now, that said, we realize, of course, as we've been saying on the show, that health care is only one piece of the puzzle in terms of addressing the overall health of the Lehigh Valley. We spend 18% of our GDP on health care, but only 3 cents out of the dollar of that health care dollar is spent on education, health education, public health, and prevention. So part of the conversation systemically is we're going to have to really think about developing a much more robust public health education, and awareness about health in terms of the health behavior change and social and economic factors that influence health above and beyond the 18%. I don't know, but it clearly we haven't paid as much attention as we need to. And so there are two things that I'd mention that are really big from a systemic standpoint. One is that 18% is how sustainable is that number? And what's happened, oh my goodness, going back to 1965, is that as a nation we've struggled with health care costs for decades and decades and decades. Increasingly, hospitals and health care systems are going to feel tremendous pressure from the economic forces that will change the nature of hospitals and health care. It's happening, and it's going to happen. Increasingly, healthcare systems are not going to be paid on the volume of care that are provided, but on the value of care provided. So once we're revenue streams for hospitals in terms of people come into the hospital, we have procedures, we do tests, we do things, and how revenue are generated, those revenue streams are becoming cost centers. Those economic forces are increasingly going to change the way hospitals are financed and how they have to think about how they provide care. So increasingly, the financial model for healthcare reimbursement is going to tilt more toward a better model to think about providing the kind of service that people need to keep them out of the hospital in the first place. So the economic forces that are driving healthcare service delivery change are actually aligning with what we increasingly know about these social determinants of health. And so less appreciated, and I'm so happy we're talking about it today, but less appreciated are these other forces and dynamics that influence whether someone's healthy or not, and generally known as social determinants of health. Well, I never get the numbers right, but let me break it down more or less.
Sure.
Genetics account for about 30% of a person's health, just what you're born with. So pick your parents very, very carefully. that package that you receive at birth determines 30% of your health. About 20% of what would determine your health are social and environmental conditions, education, attainment, income. So there's 50% of what determines health right there.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare, hospitals and doctors account for about 10%, and about 40% of what determines healthcare is individual behavior. Do you take the elevator or the stairs? Do you get the side salad or do you order the fries? Do you smoke or do you not smoke? Do you wear seatbelts, yes or no? Do you get some reasonable exercise on a regular basis? 40% would determine whether you're healthy or not. So we spend 18% of our gross domestic product on health care, but we know that perhaps 50, 60, 70% of whether someone's healthy or not is not determined by health care, but in fact determined by individual behaviors that people have. And the funding for that, as I said, is about to go after those kinds of things from a healthcare perspective is about 3 cents on the dollar. So how do we get smarter and better about thinking about that kind of work systemically? How do we get more focused on the Lehigh Valley in particular? But then how do we get more granular in terms of having real, meaningful conversations at a neighborhood level, at a community level about how do we keep ourselves healthier? How do we do this in a way that would be important? And so if we think about it just from a health care or a health perspective, we're missing so many pieces of the puzzle, which is where we then, I think, have to shift to thinking about, okay, how does health interact with housing? How does education interact with health? How do we have the framework right yet to talk about that? Because it's big, it's complex, and it's a little overwhelming unless you can frame it in a way that you can put it into meaningful chunks.
When you see a problem, how do you decide which problems to focus your efforts on? I mean, you must get a lot of requests. What's your problem-solving process? How do you look at something and say, you know, this is good, but we really need to go here?
Well, I think one of the key things is listening. And, you know, not just assuming that because we've looked at the county health rankings, we understand what needs to be done. So a really important part of this is listening to what community and trusted partners are saying about this, because it really is going to take a whole bunch of folks from various sectors to sit around and discuss about, and community plays a huge role in this, in about what needs to be done and, more importantly, how it needs to be done.
Is it difficult to separate emotion from data?
Both are extremely important. Several long-time acquaintances who taught me the expression no data without a story and no story without the data. And so both are extremely important. You could have a compelling story, but unless you're able to really slice and dice the synthesis and analysis of information, you limit your chances of being successful. On the other hand, if you're just looking at the data, without listening, without engaging, without really very, very proactively becoming involved as best as you can with the people who, as some of our colleagues say, are closest to the pain, then it's a little hard to have as deep an understanding as you need to really think about how do you put your energy and your passion into doing this work.
Before we go into a break, a lot of people who listen to us start asking themselves questions, and they'll want to look into who the organization is and what they do. Can you give us a website address so that in case people want to listen to our last segment, they can follow along by multitasking? What's the website?
The website for Pool Trust and Ryder Pool Foundation is pooltrust.org. Pooltrust.org. You'll see a screen that will invite you to go into either Pool or Ryder Pool Foundation. They're two separate 501c3 organizations with two separate executive directors. And Ron and I have the pleasure of working for both organizations. And you can click, pull down those boxes and see some of our prior stories and links to various kinds of information that you might have and references to other things that might be of interest. It wouldn't be the first stop, but hopefully it's a prompt into other things you might want to look up, like county health rankings.
I would encourage our listeners to do this, even if you're listening right now. It's really interesting work that these gentlemen do, and we'll learn more about it when we come back after this. You are listening to WDIY.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Very happy to have Ed Meehan and Ronald Dundas of the various Ryder Pool Foundations. Ed, we were talking earlier, and you made the comment that what we do in calm determines what we do in crisis, and we do find ourselves in the middle of several crises.
Correct. And it was a comment I made to you the other day when we were talking. We, as of about March 10th, 11th, we realized that we had to think long and hard about how we were going to respond to COVID-19 as it began in earnest in the Lehigh Valley. And we're not frontline workers, you know, and it's something we've said for years. We don't visit the sick. We don't read to children. We don't provide meals to shut-in and elderly. We don't do that. We're only we provide funding, and hopefully we provide other kinds of support, but we're only as good as the people we fund. And so we hit this crisis of how do we respond to COVID-19, and we realized that all of the work that we've done over the years in terms of thinking about being, quote, place-based, having a sense of place, the Lehigh Valley, but particularly neighborhoods in particular, and the idea that we have good relationships with not-for-profits that are doing the frontline work enabled us to be agile, turn quickly toward how can we respond. And so, you know, when I think about the things that you do in calm determine what you can do in crisis, because we have good relationships with many of the folks who are providing services, because we have a collective impact fellowship, because we've been proactive in our grant making, because we have good community surveillance and data, all of these things that we've been doing for a very long time now, but certainly heightened in the last 6 or 8 years, enabled us to turn on a dime and hopefully provide the resources that we to these agencies that could provide real immediate response.
You're able to react quicker.
I would like to think we were able to react quicker, and we were able to react very much more responsibly. I have to say, we are so lucky to have two boards of directors that are supportive and encouraging and just tolerant of us in some of this effort that we do. But, you know, our ability to kind of just be agile and flexible, we're a small organization. You know, unlike government, which might take longer, but have much, much more resources, we could turn quickly, we could move relatively small amounts of money and deploy them quickly. So, and Ron can tell you a little bit more about that.
Ron, can you give us a little insight into how you're working in the community right now and the good things that you're doing out there?
Well, when it came to a rapid response to COVID, we really kind of took the approach of relief, recovery, and now moving into resiliency. Look, at when COVID hit the Lehigh Valley, we knew pretty early on that the folks that were going to be the most impacted by COVID-19 were going to be our seniors, especially those who, you know, are now shut-ins and don't have access to food, et cetera. Two was going to be the homeless population, and three would be our vulnerable poor populations. So we wanted to be able to respond quickly to those three populations. And the fact that through the Collective Impact Fellowship, which is our leadership development program that nonprofit leaders have an opportunity to go through, we have some really good trusted partners that we know they do good work. They know us. We could just kind of say, hey, guys, what do you need? What's happening out there, and how can we respond in a very quick manner? And we were able to, through these great partners, get some immediate activities going on around making sure that seniors and the homeless had access to food, because senior centers were closing and soup kitchens were closing. So how do we make sure these folks have access to good, healthy, nutritional food? And through a collaboration with Meals on Wheels, we were able, and Lehigh Valley Health Network, we were able to get hundreds of meals out to these folks in a really, really timely manner. we were identifying in some of our poor communities that that they weren't getting the public health message around social distancing, around washing your hands, around wearing a mask. And because of our trusted partners, we found out the reasons why were twofold. One is, look, not everybody is listening to Dr. Fauci on TV.
Right.
Not everybody is getting that information, isn't trickling down to particular neighborhoods. And secondly, they're not coming from trusted partners. So communities are going, the government's telling us this. I'm not sure that's true. So where are those trusted partners, and how do those trusted partners provide good public health information to the community? And a huge, huge shout-out to Hassan Botts and the Promise Neighborhood folks who really kind of embraced this idea of credible messengers and got really good public health messages out to the community in a really timely way. And again, we're not talking about big resources here. We're talking about small insertions of funding and a lot of flexibility that allows good frontline folks to do amazing work with the community.
So what I'm hearing is the various communities that we have within our community have leaders, and in order to disseminate these helpful hints or helpful health practices, you really need to get to that community leader first, who then presents the activity that the community should be practicing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not only are we disseminating good public health information this way, credible messengers are also bringing back information to us and to the healthcare and public health systems where they're able to say, hey, look, we've got a real problem here, because there are a lot of young moms with babies who they don't have diapers, they don't have formula. People are sheltered in small apartments. You know, we're going to start seeing an uptick in domestic violence. We're going to start seeing an uptick in depression and anxiety. There's potential upticks for violence. So that moves us to the second piece of recovery. You know, we're able to work with frontline folks to get some immediate relief that people are safe, people have good information, people are getting basic needs met. Now into recovery of, okay, just as we work to stop the spread to flatten the curve around the spread of COVID, how do we flatten the curve around domestic violence, around mental health, anxiety, depression, education, digital divide, all of the factors, the social determinants that we were talking about that now get exacerbated by COVID-19. And so being able to respond to start addressing some of these things, again, through trusted partners in the community, become really important.
Is it fair to say that at-risk communities have a higher propensity to be at risk of these various things that happen as a result of COVID-19?
Yeah. It took our vulnerable, poor communities of color, and it just added a whole new level of disparity to this work. So it's not like, uh-oh, here's something new. All this did was amplify what was already present in these communities.
This is a hypothetical, you know, just as a not a specific person or persons, but if a husband and a wife and two kids are living in a 2,500-square-foot house with a backyard and they have to quarantine in place, okay, it's a little bit of hardship.
Mm-hmm.
If a woman has three kids and her sister's coming to stay with her two kids, and her mom is there as well, and they're all in an 800-square-foot apartment that's a walk-up, and there's a little bit of a challenge to figure out how to access public transportation to still get to work. There's no Wi-Fi connectivity, so you can't do online education for the kids. All of these social determinants about access and options, choices, as Ron said earlier, are going to impact. And so the stress is just that much heightened by COVID-19.
So let's talk about some of the good things that your organization's doing right now. Specifically, as an example, the ISS, the educational programs. Ultimately, these help, don't they?
I think that in order for systems and communities to work together, One, they have to know each other. They have to have a trusting relationship. That doesn't just occur when you stick three people in a room or 15 people on a Zoom meeting. And if we really want to make progress on some of this, we need trusted partners around the table. And there needs to be an understanding of how these different systems work and influence the work that each individual system does. And most important there is that folks from the community, as Ed said earlier, folks closest to the pain are authentically involved in these conversations. They understand the problem way more than we ever will.
So one of your programs improves graduation rates, improves the stay in school program. You have some outstanding successes here. Talk about some of the impactful things that Ryder Pool is doing that ultimately become successful at this time.
Well, first of all, let's acknowledge that the numbers that we're trying to change, the needles that we're trying to move, it takes a generation. You're not going to, in one fell swoop, increase graduation rates in the Allentown School District. It's not going to happen. When more than half of the children in the Allentown School District start kindergarten below kindergarten readiness standards, we know that's going to, you know, that intervening at the pre-K level is going to have an impact on graduation rates, but that's 12 years later. So we've got to recognize it's generational work. We need indicators to show success, but we're not going to see those dramatic changes in county health rankings for 5, 10, 12 years. That's when we'll start seeing those significant changes. So how do we bolster pre-K services at the same time as bolstering, making sure that every child is born healthy, making sure that every child has an opportunity to a solid cradle-to-career pipeline opportunity? So these are the systemic changes that we just can't say, education system, it's all on you, that healthcare has to play a role in this, government has to play a role in this, housing has to play a role in this. These are all really important factors that are going to increase graduation rates, that are going to increase health outcomes, that are going to increase employment rates, that are going to increase quality of life. So everybody around the table, and again, most importantly, community has to be there to let folks know what needs to be done, and they need to be there as trusted partners.
So when you take data to stakeholders, do you feel like you are getting the type of patience that's required for these generational adjustments and improvements?
Yeah, I think that that a lot of the folks that are stepping up really understand social determinants, really understand the work that needs to take place, really understand that this is, you know, really long work. These systems and policies and methods have been in place for decades, and you know we're undoing a lot of things that have just been done the same way for years, and that takes a great deal of work. It takes a great deal of patience. We need short-term approaches. You know, we're not going to neglect juniors and seniors in high school. We want to make sure that they're graduating, that they have opportunities for mentors, for safe experiences, for access to good quality health care in order to impact graduation rates, as well as that child that's being born right now.
Can you give us an example of you've identified an interventional strategy and take that to the implementation strategy, something that you've done where you say, wow, look at this.
Ron, do you want to talk about the Blue Guardian or any of the fellowship work around opioids?
Sure. One of the areas that was identified was about once a week, a pregnant woman is overdosing from heroin. So there's a situation where not only are we talking about the health of the mom, but we're also talking about the health and well-being of the baby. And, so there were a lot of systemic barriers that were being identified. Where does a pregnant woman go for detox? Where can she go for good quality care where she's not going to have to worry about the immediate response is they're going to take my baby? And whether that's justified or not is irrelevant. It's a barrier to prevent somebody
Sure.
from accessing care. So through the leadership of Lane Turner and at Lehigh County Drug and Alcohol and Jim Martin from the District Attorney's Office, they created a way of identifying overdoses within 24 hours. That's through police contact and through first responders. Let's make sure that we're getting to these folks in a really timely way and identify, especially for pregnant women, a pathway to detox and recovery. And they were able to get, I think, around 100 pregnant women over the last 3 or 4 months into good quality care, with most of them, I don't have data available to me, delivering healthy babies.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, our time is about up. First, before we say so long, get a commitment to have both of you back on again.
Anytime, Greg.
Love to.
This has been a quick hour. The website, once again, people want to learn more about the Ryder Pool Trust and Foundation. The website again, please.
Pooltrust.org.
I'd like to thank Edward Meehan and Ronald Dendis, an outstanding program and information for all of us to use. Follow their work. It's outstanding, and they've dedicated their lives to this. Also like to thank Neil Heaver, our engineer and operations manager today, for his good work. You are listening to WDIY, and this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Have a good evening.